Sure. Yeah, let's hit it. So in that Performance Max campaign, we want that campaign. So Performance Max is going to hit Google Shopping. It's going to hit demand generation. It's going to hit search. It's going to hit YouTube and display. So all five categories of Google, all built into one. First, you're going to acquire customers as fast as you could profitably acquire customers. And those customers will eventually come back again to build some lifetime value. They might not all come back. Those are metrics you need to build over time. But some may come back. Retargeting on Google can be done in two different ways from how I see it. The first way that we can handle retargeting on Google is hand in hand with that demand capture. Let's just say I was again shopping for Yeti and then I jumped off the search. I didn't make a purchase.
So on this episode of the 2X e-commerce podcast, we uncover advanced strategies for optimizing your Google Ads and Meta campaigns, including scaling with Advantage Plus and mastering cost-effective creative testing. It's a great episode you don't want to miss, so do stay tuned.
This is the 2X e-commerce podcast, hosted by Kunle Campbell.
Welcome to the 2X e-commerce podcast. In today's episode, we delve deep into the world of digital advertising with advanced strategies to optimize both your Google and Meta ad campaigns. This is a follow-up from last week's insightful conversation with Sam Piliero. You'll learn how to effectively scale your campaigns using Advantage Plus, set up efficient cost caps, and implement strategic creative testing to boost your ad performance. This episode is packed with expert insights, practical examples, and actionable advice that will help you manage your advertising budget more efficiently and maximize your ROI or ROAS. Stay tuned as we explore the real-world case studies and industry trends to keep you ahead of the curve in digital marketing. Before we dive into this interview, make sure you follow the 2X e-commerce podcast on your preferred platform by subscribing. You stay updated with the latest episodes and also help us attract even more interesting guests to share their expertise. So let's get started. Hey, Sam, welcome again to part two of our interview.
Yeah, I'm happy to be back. Part one was fun. And I think we were just scratching the surface. So I'm happy to get more in depth here and really dig in. I'm excited to be here again. Thanks for having me.
Incredible. So I'll just recap, because most people listening to this would have listened to part one. If you haven't listened to part one already, just click back to this episode on your podcast feed. It's the episode before this one. So they're back on back, essentially. Right. So when we had you on, you sort of shared your incredible entrepreneurial journey to what you guys are doing in Moonlighters, your experience in VaynerMedia, BarkBox. We talked about your agency structure, how it's kind of like singularized. So you don't really have the hierarchy, it's flat. We spoke to demand gen and demand capture. The reason we did that is demand generation, essentially what you guys do from a meta standpoint, meta advertising standpoint. Demand capture is what you do predominantly, not all the time, from a Google AdWords, you know, mm-hmm. standpoint. And then we spoke very briefly on on contribution margin, just the fundamentals, you know, people should get a grasp around. And then we spoke to YouTube advertising, just the role of YouTube advertising, mm-hmm. and then UGC. And we had to sort of wrap up. And I kind of felt there was a cliffhanger there in the sense that we didn't really get deep into like meta. I know we spoke about attribution and, you know, in the meta structure and all of that stuff, but I would like us to start this conversation more around your, let's use this mental model. You know, say we've built a $1 million business on mm-hmm. one channel, right? Say it was Amazon Marketplaces, just as an example.
Sure.
And we're looking to essentially, you know, get to a few million dollars in revenue, say 5 million with D2C mm-hmm. and Amazon in tangent. So meaning that the D2C is fresh, you know, off the back. How would you sort of ensure that transition from zero D2C to 2, 3, maybe even yeah. 4 million, who knows? So what are the fundamentals you want to see in place in the business to say, okay, these are the prospects and this is what we'll do?
So I love this example because for two reasons. First, I think it's this, what I'm going to say is going to be exactly the same as if you're zero without a sale anywhere else. The exact same process. The only thing that the example with, let's say you've done $100,000 or $1 million on a different channel like Amazon, the only thing that that expedites for us is that you've proven that the product is actually strong. It's a good product fit. And therefore, you kind of eliminate a lot of stages of like product development and product iteration and potentially even some branding pieces. So keep in mind, if, you know, obviously for everyone listening here, I think just to keep in mind that this doesn't matter if you're at zero on all channels or if you have a bunch of money flowing in from a different channel. And basically, just to use the exact example that you gave, I think it totally makes sense that first off, you should definitely have a direct-to-consumer piece of your business if you have potentially $1 million plus on Amazon. Even if you're not advertising or pushing to the direct-to-consumer side, it's still going to help you operationally and give you incremental lift because some people, believe it or not, don't actually buy from Amazon and don't actually buy from just one channel, just like some people only buy on Amazon. Same idea follows. So I think what I would do if there was $1 million business on Amazon, regardless of the product, I always love to use, I use Yeti in a lot of my examples, and I just so happen to be drinking from a old Yeti cup today. And I think that that's probably a solid example. We'll go with a $30 price point product. You have product fit. You're doing $1 million on Amazon. The first thing I would do, obviously, is we need to build the site. We need to build it as simple as possible. And we could use all of our imagery, all of our key, you know, any descriptors, any reviews that are from Amazon, everything ported over into the direct to consumer site. Don't worry if it's not perfect at first. What we want is simple, fast, and review heavy. Reviews have driven your business on Amazon. They're going to continue to drive your business on direct to consumer. I think people get caught up when they think about like conversion rate optimization and beautiful landing pages and perfect imagery and like funnels and flows. The reality is, like, that stuff helps, but it's not going to get you from zero to one. It's going to get you from 1 to 50 or 10 to 50. So first stage, fundamental setup, right? Simple, sleek, use what you already have. I know we want to gear this conversation a little bit towards advertising because that's what I know best. So the first thing I would do if you're driving already on Amazon is I would already set up Google. You have probably some product market demand. And if you're doing $1 million on Amazon, chances are you have a lot of keyword data that you could use and port over to Google. So Google is going to be absolutely my first thing that I would do. I would set up a standard performance max campaign that drives only to shopping ads with your best images, your best reviews. And I would populate every single headline, every single primary text, like just max this whole thing out. Once you set that up, it doesn't necessarily matter what budget you're setting this for because it's truly going to be up to your tolerance on budget. But let's just go with, we're going to run with $100 a day, right? Don't think that you can get away with $20 a day and build a big business. Like, start at a foundationally small spot, crank it up day after day after day. The beautiful part about, especially if you're not working with an agency or you're not paying a consultant, if you're doing this on your own or if you're doing it with one partner or something like that, the beautiful part is it doesn't matter how slow you grow. Now, I know that feels so contrary to everything else I've probably ever said, but basically you have the ability to sit back and move things up day by day by day steadily into your targets that you've evaluated. The next thing I would do outside of that performance max campaign on Google is I would set up a both branded and a non-branded search campaign. Very, very straightforward. The branded search campaign is going to be all your brand terms. You should have these already from Amazon. It should be your core terms. If you're Yeti, it should literally just be Yeti, maybe Yeti cups. Very, very simple. You don't need to overcomplicate here. if this only gets $2 in spend per day or $0 in spend, it's fine. It's just protecting you against competitors, right? So when Stanley Cup bids against Yeti, we want to show up in the first position. We don't want to show up in position number two or potentially get completely pushed down on the end of the page. Last thing, non-branded search. If you're running on Amazon, you have a ton of keyword data, like whether it's organic or paid, you have a ton of data. So use all of that data, group it very simply. You don't need to overcomplicate your groupings when you're starting. Run a few broad match keywords and a few exact match keywords in the same ad group. That is probably the most counterintuitive thing that we've heard in Google Ads in the last 3 to 4 years. But right now, really over the last 6 months, we've been experimenting with this. What happens when we group together different match types in the same ad groups? And we see overall better results. We see more scale, and we see no difference in cost per acquisition or return on ad spend, which is, if you told me that 3 years ago, honestly, I don't know if I would have believed you. But after rigorous testing against this, against 20 some odd brands, it's clear that it works better like that. So that's the first.
And can you track keyword performance when you lump them all up in an ad group?
What do you mean?
So individual keyword performance. So if you're lumping a phrase match, an exact match, and a broad match into a single campaign, into a single ad group, are you still able to know exactly what keywords or search phrases or match types actually delivered, your conversions?
Yes.
So does it matter?
So first you could see the data at the keyword level, like how you're setting it up, whether it's broad, exact, phrase. Hmm. Then you can go into a little report in your campaign, left-hand side, called Insights. And in the Insights, there's a search term report, and that's going to show you exactly the word that was used to derive your product and showed up. Whether you got a click, just impression, or conversion, all of that data will be there for every single search term that you ever showed up on. The one thing Google's doing there more often is they're grouping things into other. Other is basically terms that don't happen too often. So if someone typed in Blue Yeti cup with this, like if they got really, really, really particular about what they were talking about in the product, and that's extremely rare search, Google kind of docks that down now into an other category, where previously you did get to, unfortunately, or you did fortunately get to see that. Now, unfortunately, we don't get to see that.
Okay. Interesting. Didn't know that.
I'll hit you with the part two of this now, which is what do we do on the meta side, right? So on the Google side, we're really about capturing existing demand, right? There's...
I didn't hear much about like Google Shopping in this. Oh, okay.
Yeah, let's hit it. So in that Performance Max campaign, we want that campaign. So Performance Max is going to hit Google Shopping. It's going to hit demand generation. It's going to hit search. It's going to hit YouTube and display. So all five categories of Google, all built into one. Now, we have to be really careful about Performance Max, because what we don't want it to do is run all in search or run all in demand gen or all in display. We want Performance Max to be dominantly a shopping campaign. Shopping is the core of everything we're going to do in Google, right? Everything else I think of as supportive of shopping. So right now, shopping holds the number one search or the number one spot on any Google search that's product related. So we need to dominate those placements. So what I'd like to do is that Performance Max campaign should serve as your primary shopping campaign. Now, there's scripts out there. There's a lot of ways to view this data. But basically what you just want to do is when you look in your insights, you want to compare how much money you're spending in shopping versus how much your total campaign is spending. So if your total campaign is spending $1,000 over a week-long period, look at how much your products have spent. And if your products have spent, say, $300 of that $1,000, that's a bad ratio. You want that ratio to be at like 80%. Go ahead.
Of shopping. So 80% of your budget should be on shopping as an e-commerce. Okay.
I think that's bold statement, but I think 80% of your performance max should be in shopping.
Performance max. Okay. Yeah, got it. Sorry.
Even like 90% is cool as well. Like we have some brands that are 100% or 99%. Wow. And what we have seen, this feels counter because I'm basically saying build this campaign that does everything, but you only want it to do one thing. What we have seen is that when we run performance max campaign versus a standard shopping campaign, even if we just compare the wasted spend on other spots like search, display, and other places that are a little bit less efficient, it still outperforms the standard shopping campaign. Hmm. Now, I don't know if that's Google magic. I don't know if that's where they're investing their cash and they just want people to spend there, but that has been true for the greater part of a year now. So we're not pulling back on that until we start to see otherwise. Ultimately, my job is just to spend money where it's most likely to make money. And right now, mm-hmm. it's most likely to make money there. I'm going to hop over to the meta side.
Yeah, let's do the meta. So with my takeaway from what you just said with regard to Google, the world of Google, is essentially performance Google, rather, Google Ads, is performance max. And you know, try and guide performance max to spend as much of your budget into shopping because it's the best Google Ads channel for e-commerce at the moment. Okay. And then obviously keep your keywords. There's no point, rather, splitting ad groups by match type, blend them into an AdWords campaign, mm-hmm. and your final point was more around I think those are the major points.
Yeah, I think the other part was just making sure you're protecting your branded keywords a little bit,
branded and non-branded,
especially if we use the scenario of you have an Amazon presence or you have a presence somewhere else already. And just to like, you know, set it straight a little bit, this applies also like we deal with a lot of brands who have a store presence, right? We deal with a lot of fashion beauty brands. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very common that these brands do a couple million dollars in Nordstrom or in a variety of warehouse stores. Mm-hmm. And then they come to us and they try to really, really grow their direct consumer. And exactly this conversation is what we do. This is the game plan. This is phase one, right? Capture what's out there first. The reason I go to Google first is because you're going to get your highest ROI on Google. If you have cash flow in a niche, in a different channel, you've proven out you can capture demand already. So start by capturing demand in a place you're not already. Then we go to that demand generation side on the meta half.
Got it. This is super interesting. And in terms of Bing, is Bing still worth it? Could you duplicate what you're doing on AdWords on Bing and kind of get anything significant? Or do you just pass?
Yeah. Bing? Yeah. So Bing is interesting. Because Bing is so like pushed to the side and it represents, I think, something like between 8 to 12, maybe around 10% of the total searches or 10% of the size of the Google searches. So mm-hmm. it kind of like, you know, it's not perfectly there. It's not that large. Their shopping tools are really poor from my experience. Their search mm-hmm. tools are very strong. Their search tools are completely fantastic. So what we generally see is the person that continues to use Bing is someone who's using a default browser on a computer, right? They're using Microsoft Edge. I think that's what it would be. And they've never gone ahead and downloaded Chrome or Brave or Firefox or something like that. So by using Edge or by using Bing, you're kind of grouping yourself into a different category. You're likely less technical. Or you just love Bing, but you're likely less technical if you're not using one of the dominant browsers. So what we tend to see is that Bing clicks tend to be a bit older in age. They tend to be less technical. And then for certain products, they work super, super, super well. An example of a couple of brands that we work with in Bing are I can't give exact examples, but brands that are they just skew older. And even on price point doesn't matter. So what we like to see on Bing is about 10% of the budget that Google could yield is what Bing could hit at the same return on ad spend. So if you spend $10,000 a month in Google, you could probably spend $1,000 in Bing at the same ROI.
Okay. And then in the Google space, at what point do you start really taking retargeting and display seriously?
So it's a fantastic question. And it's honestly the hardest Google question. Retargeting on Google can be done in two different ways from how I see it. The first way that we can handle retargeting on Google is hand in hand with that demand capture. Let's just say I was again shopping for Yeti and then I jumped off the search. I didn't make a purchase. And then I went into the search bar and I typed in, metal cup or whatever these are, insulated cup. Instead of searching for Yeti, I searched insulated cup. The retargeting method that I would want to use there is making sure that I am using a customer list to bid very aggressively on the person that was previously on my site to then show up in the non-branded search. So the reason for that is very simple, right? The user is clearly indicating that they're still showing tendency or a likelihood to purchase. And what I didn't want to happen was for us to put all our work with that user on the site. They're sold. They know they need to get an insulated cup or they know they need to get a certain product, but they just don't know what brand they want. So now we need to do our job to close the loop. The second thing you can do for that is what all the competitors should be doing in that scenario. If anyone visits Stanley Cup, we then want to show up as Yeti, first and foremost, top dominant every single time someone bounces from the Stanley site. Now, we don't have first party data. We have third party data that's coming from Stanley. So it's less informed. But what you can do is you could set up retargeting audiences for people who visited URLs, which puts you at a massive advantage. You just have to take the time in these platforms to properly bid based on what your users have done and what they're most likely to continue to do.
Interesting. I only thought retargeting was based on your property. So visits to your URL with your cookie, so firing, although there's longer cookies, but yeah, with whatever they used to track these days. Firing and then cookies. But you can target third party. So you could, in your case, target to all Stanley visitors,
It's not perfect, right? So it's not, it's not as good as someone who's visited your site. You're telling Google, people who have visited Stanley is someone who I'm interested in, right?
And then
Google then has to decide in the auction where they're going to put you in that playing field. Okay. Now, I'd imagine if Stanley is also aggressively retargeting their existing people who have been on their site, they're going to outbid you very quickly, right? Because they're more relevant to the last person who was there. Just like if we were doing it on our side, we're doing a Yeti versus Stanley thing here, but there are just ways to get strategic. I wouldn't necessarily call it like retargeting. It's probably just straight up targeting, right? It's like normal targeting.
Yeah, that is targeting, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about it as like conquesting, competitive play. It's very tactical. It's how you outmaneuver competition, especially when you're dealing with big competitors in your space.
Yeah. And Facebook automatically does this, for you. So once you're in the market, it identifies, okay, you're in the market for insulated cups. Facebook would pull a number of brands and just cycle them through. Obviously, depending on who bids, whoever, it would just cycle and cycle and cycle. And when it thinks you're no longer in the market, it switches lane. It wouldn't, because I'm in the market for, say, an activity strap in January, doesn't mean Facebook will continue to serve me activity strap ads by summer. It sort of has a cutoff time based on, obviously, my data, my behavior. But super interesting, super interesting. So on the Meta side of, the other thing I wanted to talk about in the AdWords was Gmail. Gmail is big. A lot of people feel it's underrated, but Gmail. I use Gmail, and you know, I my click through rates to their ads. Their ads are, first of all, quite relevant. Yeah. I have to say, and they know quite a lot about me, you know, based on the emails that I received. So should you do anything special with Gmail?
I used to love to run Gmail on its own. It was something I'd done. I just was really heavy on because it worked so well. It felt not invasive to the consumer. I think consumers are so used to getting so many emails. So if you just hit them with a good offer in Gmail, it would work well. Now, Gmail individual targeting is now lumped into demand generation and performance max. I think there's ways to do exclusions on different placements to only hit Gmail. Honestly, it's not something we run as much anymore. It's been less effective. There's two reasons for it too. More and more people are downloading secondary mail apps because they're so sick of like the amount of spam, how hard it is to unsubscribe. So secondary mail apps like Spark and Proton Mail, a bunch of other ones are getting more and more popular. And then second, and actually a note on that, you actually technically get the delivery on that, but it gets pushed away. So you don't actually, you get served an ad. You may actually pay for that ad, but you don't actually get the ad. It's like an invalid click in a way.
That is when these third party mailing apps.
Yeah. I think
retrieve
it depends
your
on,
data.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it depends on which one, but you're on it. And then the last part about Gmail, that if you're doing this, if you are very specific to Gmail, if you've had success there in the past, just offer strong. And one little tidbit of advice when you're sending offers in honestly regular email or also on Gmail ads, whatever your offer is, use the biggest number. So if you have a $1,000 product and you give 10% off, lead with $100 off instead of 10%. And then vice versa, if you have a $10 product and you're giving 40% off, don't say $4 off, say 40% off. That little hack, we'll call it, switches the consumer behavior to actually understand this offer is big, and then therefore you could reap the benefits.
Makes sense.
Did you want to dive into Meta?
Yeah, let's jump into Meta. I think that was, you know, thorough sort of masterclass to anyone listening on AdWords, on Google AdWords. Last episode we did talk about YouTube advertisers. I'm not going to really talk about it, but those are the really big placements that that stand out for me on AdWords. And it's really interesting with this advantage plus. You know, setup. So thanks for that. So in Meta, how would you proceed?
Yeah. So I think like what everyone's going to want to hear is the setup that we're using in Meta and like how we approach that and why we do things a little bit different. So I'll kind of spill the whole sauce and I'll bring it down from if you're at zero, how we would scale it up. So basically, fundamentally, we like to use cost caps on Meta. I think I explained this a little bit last time, but basically what a cost cap is, or what's most common in Meta, is highest volume, it's called. A highest volume campaign is essentially you say, hey Meta, here's $500, and it will spend somewhere between 498 and 500. Like it spends your whole budget every single day, basically. There's problems inherently with that based on demand, market behavior, day behavior, hour behavior, and so on. Some people love it. Some people don't have a problem with it. I'm not here to argue against those that love it. But really, what I want to drill and what we use the most is cost caps. So what a cost cap is it functions just like a target ROAS or a target CPA in Google. It's that we just do it on the Meta side. Very straightforward. You say, hey, Meta, hey, Facebook, I need to hit a $50 cost per acquisition. You literally put 50 in your notes there or in the machine. And what it will do is after it gets through the learning phase, usually somewhere in the range of like 7 to 14 days, it will only spend your cash if it thinks it can get you conversions on an average of $50 over the course of a 30-day period. I think when I say it out loud, it sounds so obvious. Like, yes, this is obviously what we should be doing. We should not just let it spend all our money. We should let the machine lean into a cost cap where it actually gets us the target we want. There's just problems when you're running cost caps and you have unproven products. The problem is very simple. If you have unproven products or unproven creative, it could be hard to scale it up and actually know what's wrong with it, right? That's a very fundamental, simple version of it. There's two sides to this. One is, yes, I need to get my creative learnings. I need to understand what's wrong. I need to really dig in and figure out what's wrong. If you have that mindset, just run highest volume, get your data, and then go to cost caps. I disagree with that. I think that you should run cost caps the whole time from zero with literally no data points in your account. And well, have your pixel set up, have your conversions API set up and that whole jam. But mm-hmm. I think you should run cost caps literally from zero, and you should set your cost caps to the most aggressive point that you can. So I love to operate a business that's starting out at a break even. So figure out what's your revenue, average order value, what's your cost of goods, include other operating expenses, and get a rough break even where you need to be, right? So you know that if you have $100 average order value, cost of goods are 50%, and everyone else costs you only 5%, then you need to get a $45 acquisition cost to break even on your product. I love this for two reasons. First, you're going to acquire customers as fast as you could profitably acquire customers, and those customers will eventually come back again to build some lifetime value. They might not all come back. Those are metrics you need to build over time, but some may come back, and then that's what I consider like gravy, so to speak. So when we think about the cost cap setup and why I think it's so important to start at that break even and then build it over time is because you're setting yourself up in a scenario where if your ads don't spend, you should thank Facebook. You're not wasting your money, right? Some people, like I said, they see that as, oh, we're not spending. Maybe it's going to work. I think the 1 in 1,000 times that it does work is probably not going to happen. Like just statistically, you would not bet your money on the 1 in 1,000. You would bet your money on the farm. So
can I interject?
Yes, yes, yes.
I think it also gives you the opportunity to rule out certain things. So if it's not spending, then there you say, okay, it's not spending. Is it my creatives that's the issue?
Yeah.
And then focus there. That's just my point.
100%. Sorry, I get into this topic. So yeah. I think you're absolutely right. Like here's how I would approach it from dead zero. Cost cap in one primary campaign. You don't need any retargeting. You don't need any retention. You're at zero. So all you need to do is have one broad prospecting campaign. Like that's it. And you might want to set up one that's going to your homepage and one that's going to a collection page. And then depending on how many products you have, maybe a campaign that's going to a product page or two or three product pages that you know are bestsellers based on your Amazon data or a hunch that you have and so on. You could have somewhere in the range of like a few ads per campaign, somewhere in like the 4 to 6 range is usually the sweet spot. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is, if you launch these 4 ads and they run for 7 days and they're hardly spending, maybe you have a $100 budget and it's only spending $3 a day, don't worry about it. Just say, thank you, Facebook, for not spending $700. And now you only spent $22. You save yourself $600. Mm-hmm. Now it's time to go make more creative. Figure out what new creative starts to build you up, right? Maybe you've only tried statics. Shoot some video. Maybe your video is really polished and it's too fancy. Make it ugly, make it natural, make it normal. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's too normal. Make it polished, right? Maybe your hooks stink. Maybe they're boring. Maybe they're slow, right? Just really dig into your creative and just plop new creative in your existing ad sets. Don't worry about overlapping at first. We don't care. They're not spending. What Facebook's fundamentally going to do is it's going to look at your impressions, or it's going to look at everything on an impression to impression basis, which is something that you and I don't physically have the capability to do. No one could look at this and understand data on an impression level except for a machine. So Facebook's going to see, does this impression stay on this ad for a certain amount of time? Does this impression click this ad? Does this impression, how much does this impression cost to click this ad? What's the CPM of this impression? Every key data point is getting basically drilled into an impression level data. And then if that one impression looked good, you're going to get another impression. And if that impression looks good, you're going to get another. And that's essentially how Facebook's deciding where to spend your money. Now, what I've seen sometimes is that cost caps just take a little bit longer to get moving. And the big thing I would say here is if you're listening to this and you're kind of in that scenario where you're thinking about moving to a cost cap, you're thinking about making a switch because you're not getting, you know, the best return you want, you like the idea of having more control over your acquisition costs and less on the budget, then you have to, unfortunately, pull the Band-Aid off. You can't run highest volume and cost caps at the same time. Some may say you can. I disagree. Whenever we do this, we see our cost caps perform worse because highest volume's taking some of that juice from the cost cap. And then we also see the cost caps really have a hard time scaling, like so hard scaling. So really ripping the Band-Aid off is usually what's best.
Interesting. So at the campaign level, do you always opt for Advantage, Advantage Plus, or Advantage Campaign Budget Plus?
Okay, so very first at the top, what we like to do is set an Advantage Plus campaign. This is our scaling campaign. So I'm a visual guy. I like to think of things like kind of in blocks. The very, very top of your account is an Advantage Plus scaling campaign. It's obviously broad because it's Advantage Plus. The only creatives that go into here are your proven creatives. They have to be proven in other ad sets and other campaigns. We kind of use like a graduation program. So when those campaigns or when those ads are proving to do well, meaning like tons of purchases, strong click-through rates, strong CPCs for a valuable amount of time, like 7 to 14 days, we then graduate those into Advantage Plus. The second campaign that we have is your primary prospecting campaign. And I know you asked before, do we use Advantage Plus budget? Do we use CBO? How do we function there? We do primarily use CBO, or what's now called Advantage Plus budgets, which allows Facebook to basically decide how much spend they want to allocate to each ad set. There's some controversy around this, and if we want to actually put allow Facebook to have that power because it might not allow you to scale new creatives and so on. But my thesis is very similar to the cost cap thesis. Facebook's going to figure out, based on 100,000 signals that are way smarter than I can analyze, where it should spend our money, right? So we need to lean into some of these machine learnings. And I think in this case, you know, when I think about what needs to happen here and what needs to happen in the ad sets, I don't mind basically if one or two ad sets don't get too much spend and two to three to four do get the bulk of the spend because they're proving themselves out there strong, right? So every time we launch a new creative, we launch it into that prospecting campaign as a new ad set and we let it run on its own for about 14 days. Now, if it's doing really, really poorly, then I might pause it down. But 9 out of 10 times, I don't actually need to pause anything down because we're running cost caps, right? So we're running a tool that will only spend on creative and only spend on ad sets that are likely to hit the cost cap that we give it. So it puts us in a really, really advantageous scenario where we eliminate a cost center of creative testing. Now, we're going to naturally move a little slower when it comes to what creatives are absolutely the best because they're not going to get spent straight away. However, we're trading a tiny bit of speed. We're talking like maybe 1 week of speed per creative for fundamentally better performance, like undoubtedly more stable performance.
Yeah.
The last part of this setup that we'd like to use is retention. Now, there's a lot of debate now still that Advantage Plus and normal prospecting campaigns do a tremendous job of retention and hit your existing customers, do retargeting for you. I think what we've seen is retargeting does work really well without doing anything. We could just let retargeting do its thing, or let prospecting handle retargeting for us because we're not setting exclusions. Retention, on the other hand, is a little different. Retention basically means that someone has transacted with you. And I don't mean they've signed up for your email list. I don't mean that they've been on your site for 8 minutes. I mean that they have sent you money. Money has been transacted. There's a huge difference between someone who says they're really interested and someone who actually transacts with you. So those who have transacted with you, I like to still push them out into their own campaign. I think it still works better. It's very, very challenging to test properly. But what we've seen is that the clients that we work with, they like to spend a certain percentage on existing customers and they like to talk to them differently. Now, you might not be there if you're at zero or just kicking off and you don't even need this campaign if that's the case. But if you're a more mature business, it's probably going to help to speak a little bit differently to existing customers than it is to people who have never even heard of you before. You don't need to show the functional benefits of your product as heavily. You need to show why your product is good. You need to talk about sales and offers and new products instead of the basic benefits of your product for new customers versus existing customers. That makes sense. That kind of answer the strategy, the structure.
Yeah. Scaling at the top. You're always prospecting. You're using cost cap to ensure that spend is allocated to ads that actually will convert. And if over time, when they show that they convert quite consistently, you graduate them into campaign one, and then for more established businesses, retention, which almost mimics the messaging you have in your email, your email retention messages, offers, new product launches, and just encouraging them, over that time. Sometimes you throw in content in the retention. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that makes sense. What about ads? So, there's dynamic creative. I'm suspecting that your setup with ads is essentially individual ads. How do you test copy with ads?
Yeah, so we definitely run individual ads. We don't run any dynamic. We don't run anything necessarily special or unique from there. Some people like to, not something that we like to do. We like to see performance by ad, very straightforward. The one thing that we have been doing more this year, and it's not like there's 100% of a proven data point on this, but logically, it just makes too much sense. So one thing we've been doing more for copy specifically is we will give Facebook all 5 primary text options that it allows us to upload and all 5 headlines that it allows us to upload. There's also a little button under there. It basically says something like, use description sparingly or creative per person. The text has changed a few times, but that little button we select. And the reason for having those 5 headlines and 5 primary texts is very simple. We get to have the same ad in so many different permutations that is just way beyond what we would be able to even, not even do with unlimited time, but you can't even set up that many ads in one single ad set because the limit is 50. So if we have one creative with 5 different headlines, that's 5 right there, multiplied 5 times, it's like 5 to the 5th power. We have 25 ads automatic. And then that would only allow you to have 2 different ads in your whole ad set, which would talk about breaking the system. It would really hurt us. So we don't really care as much about figuring out what exact copy works. I'm not obsessed with copy. What I will look at is if one specific permutation of that ad works very, very well, then I actually will look at what was that copy that worked well. And then we'll just try to gear more copy to that ad. The creative itself, whether it's a video, image, GIF, carousel, catalog, whatever, that's going to be the primary factor to drive the difference. All of the primary text and so on are just going to be supportive in a better way.
Okay. And to use the Facebook, Facebook has a caption generator. Do you produce that, all the variations, the headline and description variations yourself internally? Or do you let Facebook do it?
We do a little bit of both now. A year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, It was all off the dome, right? it was all whatever you could think of would be best. Now it's changed pretty tremendously as, like, you know, AI platforms have just gotten so much better. So basically nowadays, we'll try to build out as many as we can on our own, and then we'll feed it to like a ChatGPT of sorts. And you know, I think what's important to mention here is, like, get the paid version of ChatGPT. Don't use GPT-3 or whatever version they're on right now. Like, just get the best one, because that $10, $15, $20, whatever we're paying for it, is going to be the difference between an ad that sounds like a real person wrote it and an AI wrote it. So we got to stay ahead in that regard. So use a paid version or the best version of ads. Get a bunch of them, ask for 30, put them out into a sheet, and just sift through them and make your own edits. Mm-hmm. So that's ultimately, I would say, our process right now for creating headlines and creating primary text. The great part, once you find a few winners of how your consumer likes to be talked to and your messaging, you could then easily ask for more from any of these AI platforms.
Mm-hmm. And at the Moonlighters, how do you brief your customers or your clients for creatives? Is there a process there?
Yeah, it's quite detailed. So, because it's so important, right? And we don't make our own creatives. We work with the client to get the creative that we want. So what we do on our side is we have a brief that's meant to do two different things. The first part of the brief is, we want iterations of an existing strong performing ad, and we'll show the ad that's working. We'll kind of explain the differences we want, but ultimately we want the creator to be creative and not just listen to the exact words that we're saying. Now, from time to time, we do have, like, fundamental, like, structures that we'd like to follow. One is a long form explainer. That's one of my favorites to run. And it's as straightforward as, "Hi, my name is Sam. I do this. This is my product. And this is why it's better than everyone else." And talking. So I might tell a founder, "Can you just do this intro almost spot on? Like, can you just say your name, who you are, what your product is, or what your company is? And then just talk about your product for 10 minutes. And then they can go do their creative part." So we don't script, we don't brief ultra detailed. We'd like to ride the fine line between you know, partially detailed and let the creator create.
Interesting. Okay. Then UGC versus studio produced videos, videos versus static images. That's controversial. Also, it's as controversial as cost cap on Twitter. So what's the temperature right now in all that?
All of it. I mean, I can't even stress it enough. The beauty of a cost cap setup is that if it doesn't work, it's not going to spend. Spend is performance, mm-hmm. right? So ultimately, like, just try all of it. Now, what I will say is, most of the time, if four things aren't working for you, number five probably isn't going to be your silver bullet. So if no creative format's working, then you probably need to work on product pages, overall messaging of your product. Usually what we'll see is each creative format, depending on the client, works somewhere in the range of like 10 to 30% better than the other. Mm-hmm. It's very rare we see this video works 10 times better than statics, or statics as a whole work 10 times better than all video. Of course, there's sometimes standout creatives that are that one in 1,000, but generally speaking, the types, we like to just have a mix all the time.
Okay. Facebook shopping. We never talk about Facebook shopping, which is, you know, feed driven channel or placement on Facebook. Do you care for it
a ton? Yeah. And I know that's probably a bit surprising, but actually yes is a short answer. We try to use website and shop for every single campaign that we're running. We generally have catalog in a unique campaign, and if you have two products, you don't need it, but if you have 500, you absolutely need it. And then we'll break our catalog down by different price points. use some tools. There's some good tools out there, depending on how much of your creative is coming from your catalog. So if you have 20,000 SKUs, which is surprisingly not that uncommon, you may want a system like MarPipe or something. If you're 50 SKUs, you might just be able to edit the photos on your own, or use something more simple like a Flexify, just to expand things a bit more. Basically, each of these tools just does little tweaks to your catalog. And I would just say it depends on how much of your spend is driving to catalog versus standard imagery.
Okay. There was a surge in the uptake of conversions on static images, on static ads, static image ads. Was that just a bump, or is there something there in terms of statics?
I think statics are, so I love static ads. And I know that sounds crazy, but video ads tell a story, they show your product better. Static ads tell someone to shop. Pretty simple. I think you could just think about anything you have around you and say, yes, to make the informed decision, I'm probably going to watch a video. But a static ad's going to tell me to buy now. And most of the time, the consumer journey is just so frantic. I hate the idea of a funnel these days. There's just no such thing. I might see 75 different ads over the course of 2-3 weeks. And I think I said this last time, but I might see 75 ads. And then my dad says, yo, I saw this phone case that looks real cool, man. And I'm just I'm just going to buy it now. Tell me how that fits into the funnel. I have no idea where. And maybe someone will say, oh, well, you guys got served all these ads at the same time, which is, I'm sure there's some science to it. But until we get to running Nike's budgets, I think we're at the point where we just need to say the funnel is pretty frantic, and we just need to understand that putting our best foot forward, it's literally a one step at a time game sometimes. With the best creatives we have, with all the data points we have, and leaning into the machine that's smarter than us, is going to get us the best result.
Okay. Makes sense. And then decisioning, how do you process all of the data coming through from Facebook? How do you know things are working? Things need to scale. What's your thinking there?
Yeah. So, fundamentally, is the business growing? Yes or no? Not is Facebook growing? Not is Google growing? Is the business Shopify? Is whatever you're running your platform on, is your revenue going up or is it staying stagnant? That's A. And then building the marketing dollars into a forecast. I mentioned this on our first part of this. I'm a dose of forecasting, not a focus on forecasting. Now, that dose is still important because we need to understand not only is marketing having an impact, but what percentage of your revenue is marketing? And you could kind of expect general growth based on the percentage. 10% would be stagnant growth, 20% would be growing safely, 30% would be growing aggressively. The higher you can go, the faster you're going to grow, the more risk you're taking on. Most of the businesses that come to us in that $1 to $5 to $10 million range are in that 20%, maybe 22-24% range of total marketing spend to revenue. If you could live there profitably and healthy without stressing about it, then you take away a huge lever for yourself a risk factor in your business, and you basically just say 20% of my business goes to marketing. Wipe it clean, right? It doesn't matter. 20% of my business goes to marketing, and we're just going to spend it as effective as possible. So that's definitely what I would say when we start to think about what's the next level. How do we know if things are working?
I like that mentality. Yeah, I really like the mentality of the 20% going to marketing, and we need to efficiently, spend that 20%.
Yeah.
It just puts things into perspective. It's kind of like, what you're talking about, the cost gap, in terms of just it's given you assurance, right? There's predictability there, and it's up to you to take destiny into your own hands. Okay, so let's step a bit top level now again. So we talked about Google Ads, we talked about Facebook Ads. What kind of spend allocation, like budget allocation, do you think will go where, and how do you see Google Ads synergizing with Meta? What are your thoughts there after like 6-12 months of spend? Yeah. The way you've described it,
capture 100% max out on Google first, max out. Then, well, I guess it depends. Max out into an ROI, because your effective capture is going to be the best for you. We talked a bit about like, do you trust the platform data? How to use the platform data? If you could just use click data, whether it's in your Shopify dashboard or Triple Whale or a whole lot of different platforms out there, or even just using the platform click data only, that's going to give you an idea of what the platforms are actually driving for you and ignoring the view through, which is going to create a lot of crossover. And the simple version of it is use your click data and derive your ROAS or your cost per acquisition from your click data, and then spend into the platform that is driving you the best ROI from that click data. The only caveat, ignore your branded search, period. Just remove branded search from that equation. Someone didn't wake up and type in your brand, right? They didn't just magically have the thought to type in your brand name. So we have to take that out of the equation. What I wouldn't do is go as far as, when you look at shopping, when you look at Performance Max, those campaigns are still going to have branded search mixed into them. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about that, because that's the same thing as the natural retargeting that happens on the Meta side. So we have to be a little bit apples to apples.
Yeah. Because when you look under the hood of many accounts, you just find that the performance numbers you're seeing really down to majority branded ads. It's interesting, just due to keyword inflation. Yeah. Right. Keywords are just like generic keywords are just so expensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're selling phone cases, it's just no point, bidding for phone cases.
Yeah, it's over.
Because some advertisers are ready to lose money just for show, just to make sure that it's a branding activity for them now. Yeah. Just to be there.
Yeah, sure.
I find. Yeah, super. Why I like to speak with you, Sam. It's really down to how you simplify things. You break things down so very simply, and I'm so grateful for that. So it captures the attention of a lot of the audience. A lot of people will be. It's not like an advanced class yet. We're discussing advanced, topics here, but you just keep it in simple English, and I appreciate it, and I'm very grateful for you for that.
Thank you.
What are your prospects for 2024? How are you seeing things panning out this 2024? And do you have any final advice to guests in terms of just growing for the rest of the year? They'll be listening to this on, I believe they'll be listening to this on May. This will be coming out on May 21, I think. Okay. Yeah, May 21. So just looking forward beyond that. Would love your thoughts.
Yeah, build for Q4. Right now. So the Q1 was very tough for a lot of businesses. Don't expect to beat your 2022, 2021, 2020 numbers, 2023 numbers. The last 3 years were a fluke. We're getting back to the normal cycle here. So if you're growing, you're in a very good position. Facebook's more expensive. Google's more expensive than ever, twice as expensive than it was a few years ago. And then tack on inflation into that gets it, we're more expensive than ever. So, my advice for folks would just be, I think about marketing as a fundamental must have in your business, and allocate, like I was saying, also a percentage of spend associated to that marketing. Don't stress about Like, does it need to be more or less, whatever? Just set yourself a percentage that works within your margins and spend it. And then it will get more efficient over time. That percentage could flex, but basically keep it as steady as possible. Make sure it works within your business. Don't try to be Uber and overspend 8 times over, right? Like some of these unicorn companies, the amount of unicorn companies that have failed on the way to try to become a unicorn is way more than the ones that were successful. And those folks spent money like it was fake. And this is not fake. If you're in the 1 to 10 million game, you're not playing with fake money. You're playing with most likely dollars that are either yours or close friends, family, or tight investors. So I would just generally warn, like, make sure your marketing budgets are set safely so that even if they return nothing, you're okay. They're going to return. But even if they return low, you're okay. And just the very last note, like, if you don't know what you're doing in these platforms, hire someone. Like, it's so critical. You would never take any other part of your business and just try to figure it out based on, especially that you're, that are cost centers. It's not only are you, like, the ROI on a good media buyer is so high. It's crazy. It's crazy to think about.
And also scary.
It's like incredibly more beneficial to have someone who knows what they're doing, not to mention the time. And then, like I said before, like, it doesn't need to be us. Just get someone who knows what they're talking about, someone you can trust and someone that you can afford, and factor that person or agency or consultant into that total marketing spend budget so that it never messes you up. You're always safe when it comes to the amount of revenue that you're driving the marketing percentage.
You're right. A lot of us are caught up with how much are we spending on Meta, how much are we spending with ads, with Google, but we're not even, you know, taking the talent, you know, cost of people on there.
100%.
This is a question I've not asked any agency, owner on this podcast, which is, if you sort of step back and look at your entire portfolio of clients, and you don't need to mention any names.
Sure.
Why do you think your top three clients that are doing really well, really, really well now, are where they are? What are their core characteristics, starting from the top?
My number one client, the client that spends, I don't want to say number one client, but like, they spend the most amount of money, right? Mm-hmm. They're on my mind.
Profitably.
Very profitably, yeah. They get the highest return on ad spend. And to just keep beating this dead horse here, like, they think about marketing as a percentage of their total revenue. So they have a very high goal for it. But if they do $1 million in a month, they spend a certain amount on marketing, period, every time, no matter what. It's clockwork. So we forecast a year, and then we forecast the next month before the month's over, before the previous month's over. We think about how much we're going to spend in that next month. And every time we get really close, because they look at their year over year, they look at the trend, right? It's not that complicated. Doesn't need to be perfect. And we spend into an ROI, and we check that every single day, basically. That's, I would say, the first, like, from a forecasting perspective. And second, this exact client and all the clients that are in our top spenders, they create content as the owner of the business. They dedicate a percentage of their entire time, not budget, just time, to making content about their business. They talk about their products publicly. They talk about, and these are not public figures by any means. I just want to be very clear. These are not celebrities. These are normal, everyday folks, just like me and you. And they talk about their product, their brand, what they're doing publicly. They tweet about it. They make YouTube videos about it. They go on LinkedIn about it. They just talk about their product, because they love it. They're in it. They know it better than anyone, right? They're obsessed with their products. And if you have a product, you should be talking about it like the thing is stapled to the top of your head. I mean, like,
absolutely,
always. And once you do that, you build a character around a product. And beyond a character, you build trust around a product. If you're willing to say, this is the best product, period, even if you're selling snake oil, people respect a face to a product.
As in that makes a lot of sense. What about their social following? Is with a regular, you know, posting of this sort of content around their product, do they have do these people, speaking specifically to your top three sure. clients, do they have a sizable social following?
They do now. Yes, they all do now. Yes, they all have over $100,000 on Instagram.
Do they do TikTok or is it Instagram?
Mostly. So I like to think of TikTok. I mean, Instagram is like your storefront, right? It's the first place people go to just check if you're legit, and then think about TikTok as like this is where we can get views right now. Yeah, very educational on TikTok. Most of these
very educational. So their personalities and their personal brands that are very linked to their products, and then they're essentially tapping into advertising to further scale. Their word of mouth that they're generating on the other side. Yeah. Do they speak outside of like, you know? So let's say like I have a health product. Do they speak to like health related stories or tips?
Yeah. So these three examples, not really. And actually they don't really push their personal brand very much. They just push, they are the face of their brand within their own handles. So they will really like just be everywhere on their own Instagram page. And that's what's grabbing so much attention.
Interesting.
It's like super a blend. It's not quite the personal, it's not an influencer pushing a brand by any means. Mm-hmm. It's a CEO owner explaining
regularly. Yeah. And so would that be one of the tips you'd have for this Amazon brand to take on?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm doing for my own brand, right? And it's what everyone should do. It's talk about your product all the time, everywhere. You can think about it, the same principle has applied forever in any sort of sales and marketing. We didn't even have computers and there weren't even cars. If we were hiking across the United States of America and I was telling everyone about this product, everyone, right? I would sell more than if I wasn't.
Absolutely.
That's the basics of it for sure.
Sam, just want to thank you again. Appreciate you. I'm looking forward to pushing this one out again. And I'm just full of gratefulness. Thank you.
Yeah, likewise. I really do appreciate you having me here. It's round two was fun. I'm looking forward to round three. We'll make sure there's a gap between round two and round three
more
new information, you know.
No doubt. If Facebook comes up with something new, you know, you tell us the war stories.
Yeah, I know.
So thing, yeah. But really, really, really good stuff. And you know, not many people get to do two full episodes. But which you prefer, one or two?
Oh man, I mean, one, we just set so much foundation. It was nice. It was more story. I think today was just like, you know, real tactical and hit some of it. Like you said, I don't get into the ultra nitty gritty of it. It's like, it's too complicated for most. And let's think about the basics of things. Lean into these machines, right? That they work.
Yeah.
They work.
Yeah. And be human.
Awesome. Awesome.
Okay. Have a good one. Thank you so very much. And cheers. Thanks.
Appreciate it. Cheers.
All right.